I'm grateful to Justice Robert Smith for helping to contextualise this talk and for preempting some of the anxieties that I might have had, because there are still many lawyers, of course, who view that that interpreters should stick to a very narrow role as an interpreter. In fact, as you probably all know, the traditional view of a legal interpreter is like a conduit pipe, like a bilingual transmitter, like a machine, or in these days, a computer. Now, interpreters, of course, can't do that. Even if they wanted to, and I'm not going to put that argument now because it's already been had, the war's been waged and lost by these people. More than that, the interpreter often does have effects, and like we had in that presentation about the survey, do you admit to omitting and adding? Well, whether you admit to it or not, if you're there on the stand or next to the person, next to the witness long enough, you will omit or add. There are also many other effects that the interpreter has to change effects upon the process, to change the perception of the witness's story or to change the perception in the witness of the lawyer's question. For example, the interpreter may blunt rapid-fire questions, one of the techniques or tactics of lawyers in cross-examination to break down a witness is to fire questions one after the other. Well, of course, if there is an interpreter there, that can't be done. There are also might be instances where the interpreter seeks clarification of a question. That can also break the flow. There are some witnesses who can't avoid or who insist upon talking to the interpreter, in other words, giving their answers to the interpreter rather than to the lawyer or to the judge or magistrate. That also has an effect. On the other hand, or additionally, there are problems with interpreters when they focus excessively on the sentence level and don't take into account the pragmatic force of questions or of replies. And then, of course, there's the lengthening or cleaning up, the grammatical cleaning up of replies that may occur where an interpreter cleans the grammar, so to speak, as it comes into the next language, or, as I'm doing now occasionally, is humming and haring or ah-ing or oh-ing, and that happens when somebody's, an interpreter might be looking for the right word. So there are inevitable effects. Now, in Aboriginal context, there's another, and also in some of the smaller community languages, there's another dynamic, and that is that often, or mostly, usually, the interpreter knows the witness. And that must have an effect on the way the witness talks to the interpreter or on any number of things. Now, Laster and Taylor, who Justice Robert Smith quoted earlier, have already argued for the redefinition of the role of the legal interpreter, and they use the term communication facilitator. And quoting from their book, this probably comes closer to reflecting the real work they perform. Communication embraces the cerebral, non-verbal and cultural dimensions of human interaction. Now, paraphrasing, facilitator rather than conduit acknowledges the active and discretionary role performed by the interpreters. So, where I'm going from here is just to put this into the context of interpreting in Aboriginal languages, and to take it a little bit further, to point out where the interpreter becomes more than a facilitator, but in fact a cultural broker. I want to read you first just a quote from an Aboriginal interpreter who wrote an article in 1973. His name is Yami Lester or Jim Lester. As soon as Aboriginal people enter the courtroom, they feel different. They become afraid. I have seen old men, in other words elders, shaking with fear. When I ask them what's the matter, they say, I don't know what's going on. The people are afraid of authority. There are so many uniformed police and figures of authority in the court. People who are frightened of the court will often plead guilty, even when they are innocent, so as to get finished and out of court quickly. They can also plead guilty because they don't know what's going on. One old lady from Merivale Station was picked up on a drunk charge. She doesn't drink at all. She went to the hotel looking for her daughter. She was worried about her. I said, "Why did you say guilty?" She said, "I didn't understand what was happening." So I said the same as the woman in front of me. And on the experience of cross-examination, I'll further quote him, he writes this: "Cross-questioning confuses people, especially about the details of time and place. They can't understand the importance of such things. They think, why are they asking me all this? Then they become afraid they might agree with anything anything or forget what they just said." Now, you layer on top of that cross-examination, other facts will... To put that further into perspective, think about the purpose of cross-examination. I'm quoting here from an advocate's instructional text by Glisson. "In theoretical or philosophical terms, cross-examination is intended to provide an opportunity to test the truth of evidence of each witness. For those engaged in the daily cut and thrust of the courts, cross-examination is more concerned with practical objectives. There are two aims only: get any benefit that you can and destroy anything else." And he goes on to say, "The aim is to destroy the witness." So you can see there that the interpreter is already in the middle of a very charged situation where the agendas of the person who leads the examination in chief, the agenda of the cross-examiner and the agenda of the court are all very different and competing. And the interpreter is often thrust, or finds him or herself, in the middle of it. So I'll show you some examples, or one example of an obvious manifestation of that. So, assuming that the situation is that the court really doesn't want to understand what the witness is saying, there is a need for a cultural broker, for a role as a cultural broker. Now, by a cultural broker, I really mean somebody who, in this context, I'm talking about an interpreter, but an interpreter who does have or can operate in both cultures, who is not necessarily bicultural, but can operate in both cultures, understand both cultures. In other words, can help to relay what's going on in one side to the other side. Now, I heard from you, Patricia, about the sanitising of Uluk-Fat-Today. The Chinese tell me, I was once told when I was 10 kilos healthier by a friend, "You're looking prosperous." In the Aboriginal languages that I speak, if you really want somebody to do something, then you say, "Can you do this? Please, long nose." And that is a compliment. So, you know, you're always playing this mental gymnastics of how to put something in an equivalent way which will get across the intended meaning with the intended nuance, if there is any, which there always is. Now, in the context of Aboriginal witnesses, what are some of the things that a cultural broker does or the interpreter does when being a cultural broker? Well, there are lots of examples, there are countless examples, but here are a few. A lawyer might ask a male witness his sister's name. He may have mentioned that he was with his sister or at the time of a certain event, not knowing that in the area where I work, that the Aboriginal man is not allowed to utter his sister's name. So the response of the witness might be to say, "I don't know," when clearly he does know. Now, if he says, "I don't know," then what's the judge going to think? Well, this witness is evading the answer, has some memory difficulty or something like that. So it is at that time that you need to say, "Look, excuse me, I'm saying this as interpreter. Aboriginal men from this community are not allowed, or from this society, are not allowed to say their sister's name." That solves the problem. Then another way can be found. The business of elders and of the question-answer style. If an elder, an older person in particular, is asked to give a statement about something that's happened as a witness, Now, first of all, he or she will give the statement to police. If they don't speak English, well, it may have an interpreter there, but the statement will end up in English. Then they go to court. Before going to court, the lawyer will check through the statement and check that this is what you said all those months ago. Then in court, the same lawyer will, in front of the judge, ask same questions about this same statement. And then, this is three or four times that the witness has repeated himself or herself, and then the cross-examiner comes and asks question after question, interrupts replies and so on, and it's no wonder, unless people understand the nature of the game, it's no wonder that witnesses, Aboriginal witnesses, fall silent or in some other way become uncooperative, because they don't understand that these are the rules of the process. And so that again is the role of the interpreter's cultural broker, to seek an opportunity to clarify with the witness that this is just the way it works in the court. Another even more fundamental problem is where the witness doesn't know who's who in the court. So there has to be an opportunity to explain, well, the person sitting up there is a magistrate, this person is this lawyer for this side, this person is this lawyer for this side, that's the marshal of the court, or the, orderly, and the associate of the judge, and so on. Also, when the witness does find extreme difficulty in talking back to the lawyer but talks to you. So I've been in a situation where a witness might be asked the question of where was he at that particular time, and he'll turn to me and say, you know, Michael, that tree that's just near the creek, you know, such and such, you either have to be given the time to re-explain the role of the interpreter, or if that just happens occasionally, that comes up as a real problem, you just say the tree near the creek and whatever, without necessarily translating it exactly as he says. But again, this depends on the dynamics in the courtroom at the particular time, the interest of the judge and or magistrate in finding out what really happened. All right, now what I'll do now is just show you a few overhead OHPs about what goes on. How long have I got now? Only 5 minutes? A little bit longer. Yeah, I understand. How does this go? Goodness me. How many trials is that? Now, right up there, I just pointed out in some study that 80% or more of the questions asked by the lawyer in cross-examination are of the yes-no form. And many are posed as declaratives with reverse polarity, and there are some examples. And you were going to go across in a boat to the dead man, weren't you? Yes. And the plan was to have Bob, etc., wasn't it? Yes. Because the dead man trusted old Bob, didn't he? The dead man would come in the boat with you, wouldn't he? Yes, and so on. You see the pattern. Now, unfortunately, that comes unstuck on the occasion when the question is negativized. And here's the example. But the old man didn't go in the boat, did he? Yes. I beg your pardon? Yes. Interpreter butts in. Oh, this is an example where the witness is occasionally using the interpreter. Yes is affirming that he didn't go in the boat. The coroner pipes in. The old man didn't go in the boat. The second counsel, he's answering you exactly on point, and the coroner, you ask these questions that way, and that's what you get. Now, this was a long-running court case involving many witnesses and 30 days of hearings, and it took some time for the court to be educated also that they can't conduct themselves in exactly the same way if they want a smooth-running inquiry. So they have to learn that if they insist on asking the questions this way, that this is what will happen. Now, of course, the dynamic that was happening was that the witness was affirming the statement, not answering the tag. And that's the common pattern. The other problem with the previous one that I showed you, of these yeses, is that there's a common behaviour of gratuitous concurrence, of just saying yes. And yes has become unreliable. Now, I just want to switch over to a couple of other things with a video, with a camcorder. This is where a witness answers with something like ah, or you. Okay, what did he say? He just went one little utterance, yo. Now, yo is a bit like or something like that. It has meaning. In the context of that, it means, no, you're wrong, I still remember. So, often somebody might say or might think, well, he just said, or something, yo. So, how is this translated into a sentence? But that's its meaning. I'll just keep going.
You didn't
have any money on you?
No,
no.
So you couldn't buy your own alcohol?
He said, yeah, which means yes, and he translated no. The reason was it was fine, it was accurate, because the question was, you couldn't buy your own alcohol, could you? And he was answering like about the one with the boat. He was answering in affirming the truth of that statement, and so therefore the translation was no. If the interpreter translated it as yes, he would have misled the court and so on. So these kinds of things that came up perfectly naturally there, lawyer was the interpreter was a student of mine, but that was a wonderful example of good translation in that context. Now what I want to show you, have I got a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Now what I want to show you is another dynamic that comes into interpreting in Aboriginal context, and that is sign language. Unlike in white Australia, in the communities of Arnhem Land and many others, all members of the community both speak and sign, except of course those who are deaf, who only sign. But it means that those who are deaf still can communicate with all members of the community. But it's not the spoken language, and it's an iconic sign language, so it's not similar really to the spoken language. But of course the other thing that happens is that people who do speak who do hear often sign as well as speaking, not just gesturing but signing as well as speaking. So sometimes a witness will be asked a question, where were you, and she'll point her lips and that will show where without talking, or sometimes we'll use a sign as well as a speech. I'm just showing you a sample here of sign language so you can have a look. There was a police shooting of a mentally ill man. This is the coronial inquiry. There was some effort by the lawyers representing the police to shift the blame to apportion some of the blame to the family members. And in this case, it was saying, well, you never gave this man or made sure this man took his medicine, did you? His psychotropic medicine. So the only time when you've seen him take the medication is once in last year. That's right. And surely the family must have been concerned to make sure that he take his tablets to prevent him getting ill. Well, for that question, I would say that the family knew he was sick in the head, and from my experience living in one house, knew him very well, the way he gets sick in the head, we could wait for the right time and just cool ourselves and go politely, ask him if he wants a tablet or not. And if he didn't take them, you just let him get sick in the head. This is an important word. Yes, if he didn't want to take it, he could just walk away. And he'd get sick in the head. Yes. Now, this wasn't an interpreted conversation, but this was a second language speaker of English. Now, the real point there that didn't come out was that the witness did not recognise that there was an accusation being made. because in my Anglo culture, if my close relative doesn't take his or her medicine, then I'm doing the right thing if I hold him down and force it down his throat, or get him sectioned and taken to a mental hospital where it's done. In his culture, that's the wrong behaviour. That's the poor behaviour, and in his culture, the right behaviour is to realise and remember that you still respect the person who's older and to allow them to make the decision for themselves. So the dilemma is, does the interpreter also interpret implied accusations as part of the meaning that's available for the court? Or does the interpreter just sit with the surface translation? I think I better leave it there. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am very pleased to